This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Hi, I'm Gary Camilla. Thank you all for coming. And I'd like to thank the Lannan Foundation for sponsoring this event. I have the task of saying a few words about Dennis Johnson's work. If you're a writer, this is no easy assignment, because Dennis Johnson is what they call a writer's writer, which is kind of discreet shorthand for he's better than you will ever be. Let me give you a couple of examples. This is from Johnson's first novel, Angels. It's early in the book, page 41, and so far, if you weren't reading too carefully, you might think this is just a superior lowlife novel, like a supercharged Jim Thompson. Then you come to this. The male protagonist, Bill Houston, has just held up a store, and he wakes up to find himself clutching a gin bottle in a cheap hotel in Chicago. In his mind, he was wordless, knowing what the street was and who he was. The man with the fingerprints looking out at the street, one bare foot resting on a shoe and the other flat on the chilly linoleum. A drunk and deluded man without a chance. It was all right to be who he was, but others would probably think it was terrible. A couple of times in the past, he'd reached this absolute zero of the truth. And without fear or bitterness, he realized now that somewhere inside it, there was a move he could make to change his life, to become another person. But he'd never be able to guess what it was. He found a cigarette and struck a match. For a moment, there was nothing before him but the flame. When he shook it out and the world came back, it was the same place again where all his decisions had been made a long time ago. And you say to yourself, as you back away from the typewriter, who is this guy? He just bounced a shot off this wino's head that went straight into a side pocket in heaven. I ain't playing with him. It's the reaction a lot of jazz piano players had after they first heard Art Tatum. A sudden desire to take up the guitar. Here's another one. You have to listen closely because this magic happens really fast, like Shakespeare. It's from Johnson's fourth novel, Resuscitation of a Hanged Man. The hero, Leonard English, has just had coffee and his first conversation with a beautiful woman named Leanna. As he leaves, she touches his arm and says, Leonard. Now here's the passage. He was so entranced, he was so charmed, so captivated, rolled out flat, dreamed into, shone upon, that when she said his name, English started to live. Rolled out flat, dreamed into, shone upon. Seven little words. But they make the hairs on your arms stand up. And most of us who do this for a living couldn't fly up to those seven little words if we were strung with wires like a movie Superman. At a word-to-word level, Dennis Johnson is pretty hard to beat. It's not surprising that he started out as a poet and has published four books of poetry. There are startling, searing, lovely eruptions of poetry in everything he's written. But to me, Johnson's truly remarkable achievement is the way he has managed to reshape and extend that poetry, which is the incandescent heart of his writing, into the longer, prosaic forms of the novel, the drama, and journalism, forms that resist poetry. The books that have emerged from this collision, this hammering out of epiphanies across time, represent what must now be recognized as one of the most impressive and varied achievements in contemporary American letters. Johnson's fictional career begins with Angels, 1983, a perfectly shaped novel about the encounter between a young mother fleeing a burned-down marriage and the aforementioned criminal drifter, Bill Houston. Houston's spiritual transformation as he awaits execution on death row is one of the great acts of imaginative empathy I know. So everybody was ready for Johnson to follow Angels up with a Robert Stone-like performance, another hip, fast, deadly, poetic voyage into the American underbelly. But being predictable is not in Johnson's DNA. Instead, he published the wild and woolly Fiscadoro, a hypnotic immersion in an imagined post-nuclear war world in which human beings have essentially returned to the Stone Age. It was a shapeless, almost plotless novel written in a perfectly rendered, made-up Creole language. Then came The Stars at Noon, a blighted, sweating tale of moral betrayal in Nicaragua, unreliably narrated by a very sketchy American woman. It also featured the first of a long line of strange and scary intelligence agents who keep popping up in Johnson's work. The book's tropical third world setting and general air of corruption recalled Graham Greene. And dark religious themes reminiscent of Greene also hovered over Johnson's next and fourth novel, Resuscitation of a Hanged Man, published in 1991. This book was the first in which Johnson explicitly explored the terrain of devastated spirituality. His shaky hero is recovering from a suicide attempt and is obsessed with grasping God in a fallen world. Meanwhile, Johnson had begun sporadically working as what they call an adventure journalist. Actually, it's better to call what he did insane journalism. He blundered around through some of the nastiest places in the world and turned in pieces that are classics of long-form reportage, vivid, steely, and unforgettable. These pieces are collected in the book Seek, which is notable for containing perhaps the best description of a mushroom trip ever put on paper. Then came Johnson's most celebrated book, Jesus' Son. Based on short, semi-autobiographical sketches he had written about his youthful years as a drunk, drug addict, drifter, and generally non-productive member of society, the little volume of stories created a sensation when it was published in 1992. Jesus' Son brought Johnson thousands of new readers, as well as the first halfway decent money he had ever made. It was chosen by the New York Times as one of the best works of fiction of the last 25 years. It was made into a movie in 1999. And as anyone who has read it knows, it is a killer, an impossible, stone-cold masterpiece. Jesus' Son is a book about a man falling through life and how he somehow landed. But it transcends its subject, like all of his work, but in a savagely, exquisitely compressed form. It speaks for that part in all of us that came undone and never quite came back together. If you lost something enormous in the blizzard of years and find yourself staring into the void under the dinner table, if you just came into the world like this, obscurely broken, if you are a bell that rings purest when the note of loss is hit, Johnson speaks your language. He writes the anthem for the survivors of extremity. Success, it should come as no surprise by now, did not domesticate Johnson. His next novel, Already Dead, was possibly his weirdest yet. A demented gothic set in Northern California's dope-growing region, featuring a drunken protagonist who plots the murder of his wife and a hitman who is a literal demon. In a typical scene, they have a hilarious conversation about arcane philosophical issues as they try to kill each other with planks and pipes on a municipal pier. Johnson throws in every narrative technique but the kitchen sink. You weren't entirely sure that it worked, and you didn't care, because even when Johnson doesn't end up where he started out going, he takes you somewhere far, far away and far, far inside. He followed that with a novella in 2000, The Name of the World, about a professor struggling to come back to life after losing his family in a car crash. And around this time, just to apparently further irritatingly demonstrate there was nothing he couldn't do, he started working in a completely new form, theater. With San Francisco's Camposanto Theater Company, Johnson has written 5 plays, 3 of which have been performed. Funny and appalling, they look at rigor mortis-bound family life, feature TVs that talk back to the characters, and have lots of fun with dark interrogations of various kinds. Like Sam Shepard's plays, they're brilliant fragments of surreal Americana. That whirlwind sketch takes us up to the present, leaving out just one thing. Tree of Smoke, the big novel on which Johnson has been working off and on for 25 years. It's going to be published this fall. I just finished it, and all I can say is that Bill Houston from Angels returns, that it is about the Vietnam War, that it keeps going off in the mind like a series of bombs in a very long fuse. It represents yet another amazing and unpredictable achievement for a writer whose career has defined amazing and unpredictable. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dennis Johnson.
Thank you, Gary, and many thanks to the Lannan Foundation for having us all here tonight. I love the introductions. That's the reason I give these readings. You know, it's so wonderful. It's your life encapsulated, all the bad parts left out. It sounds like so much fun. I think I'll read a little from this book, Tree of Smoke. My publishers would be very happy if I did that. And they've been trying to get me to do some publicity, and I've been resisting it. So this, if you run into anybody from Farrar, Straus, Giroux, tell them what you heard here. I don't think I have to introduce this at all. This comes late in the novel. However, there was a period during the evolution of this thing where I decided it was too long and took part of it out and tried to make it into a novella that would stand on its own, a very mysterious novella where you don't really know who's who and what's what. So I'm just going to begin reading where this part of the book takes up. And if you don't know who's who and what's what, that's how it's supposed to be. Approaching the steps to Kuala Lumpur's old high court on the day of sentencing, Jimmy Storm looked up toward the second story and saw a number of women in bright dresses, secretaries maybe, picnicking on a balcony, taking lunch with their rice bowls in the laps of their bright dresses. As they fed themselves, they held the bowls up close to their faces, conversing, laughing, sounding almost as if they sang to one another. On the top step, he paused. He didn't know where to go. He consulted the day's printed agenda in its glass case while dropping a cigarette and grinding it out under his shoe, and then pushed through the great wooden doors of the old high court, Moorish in its architecture, tropic colonial in its spacious interiors, resonant and shadowy, dwarfing and cooling the concerns of those who came here. He took a seat in the rearmost pew of the courtroom 7, where at 1 p.m. a Chinese gun dealer named Lau would be sentenced. Then at 2 p.m., the prisoner calling himself William French Benet. One yellow fire extinguisher, 12 overhead fluorescent lights, a sign in Malaysian or whatever they spoke, Dilarang Merokok, which he took to mean no smoking. 11 wall-mounted electric fans should the central cooling fail. Storm doubted it ever would. Everything worked perfectly in Kuala Lumpur. People seemed competent and agreeable. At the front of the courtroom, a lawyer in a gray suit sat at the defendant's table and examined the evidence against his client, spinning the cylinder of what appeared to be a Smith & Wesson detective special, cocking back the hammer and taking aim for an empty, meditative moment at the elevated bench from which, according to the agenda out front, Mr. Justice Shaikh Daoud Hadi Ponusami would momentarily preside. Except for Storm, the lawyer had the courtroom to himself. He aimed the pistol at the court secretary's empty desk, in particular at the sign on it reading Dilarang Merokok. He pulled the trigger, and the pin snapped. Lunch was over. Storm heard footfalls echoing through the building. He stood up and went to a window with a view down into the driveway, where a blue van was arriving now from Pudu Prison. Lettering on its flank read, Police Raja di Malaysia. Among the half-dozen Chinese and Malay prisoners, he could easily pick out the false Canadian, Benet, his face looking white and small in the van's back window. Storm took his seat again. A few people had scattered themselves among the pews by now, a half-dozen reporters and a couple of spectators. The court's secretary came and one security guard, and then Benet's solicitor, Ahmed Ismail, entered the courtroom. He looked soft and favored with the big wet eyes of a child, arranging his papers before him in the shadow of the judge's looming bench. Very plush purple curtains covering the rear wall gave the courtroom the air of an old theater. So we might imagine it as something like this, only smaller and emptier. Very plush purple curtains covering the rear wall gave the courtroom the air of an old theater, and for a moment, Ismail looked like a schoolboy, absurdly dressed in a black three-piece suit, coming to see a movie. A staircase led up from the lower floor directly into the prisoner's box in the middle of the old high court, so that climbing it, the accused, Lau, a Chinese boy looking around himself wildly, suddenly surfaced in the midst of his dilemma. All stood for the entering Mr. Justice Ponusamy, who positioned himself behind a large ceremonial mace that rested on his desk. The prisoner leaned on the railing of his box, supporting himself with both hands. All were seated. They ran the court in English. The prisoner's lawyer explained his client didn't speak it and would use an interpreter. The boy had been convicted of dealing in firearms and of possessing a large quantity of ammunition. The judge went over the submissions, the precedents, and all the rest. The small man interpreting for the prisoner seemed nervous, sitting on his wooden chair beside the barrister and jiggling both his knees violently. When the judge addressed him, he jumped up, and the prisoner also rose, though nobody had asked him to. On hearing of his arrest, the Chinese boy's mother had killed herself by swallowing insecticide. "He does not yet know," his lawyer told the judge in English. The Chinese boy stood there oblivious. His interpreter failed to translate. "He will soon know, and that will perhaps be his biggest punishment." Justice Ponusamy never once looked at the prisoner. He gave him 6 years and 6 strokes of the rattan cane and 3 more years for the ammunition. Are you following it so far? This guy, Jimmy Storm, whoever he is, has gone to the old high court in Kuala Lumpur to observe a trial. And apparently he's concerned with a person named Binay who has not yet appeared. During the break, while they waited for the prisoner Binay to be brought up, Storm went forward and approached the lawyer, Ismail. "My name is Storm." "Mr. Storm, yes." "Your client, Binay." "Yes." "Is he coming up?" "Yes, in 5 minutes' time." "Can you give him a message for me, a message from Storm?" "I think I can, yes." "Tell Binay I'm completely capable of everything he fears." "For goodness sake, man, did you hear my words?" "Yes, Mr. Storm, you say you are capable of everything he fears." "Tell him I'll be at the prison tomorrow. Tell him it's Mr. Storm." "Is it a metaphor?" "Tell him." When Storm had found his seat again in the back, the lawyer was still watching him. Ismail turned away as his client Binay trudged up the stairwell from below them with his hands cuffed before him. He was, in fact, and as Storm had believed, William Sands. Like the previous prisoner, Sands supported himself on the railing of the prisoner's box as the judge entered and everyone stood up. Sands still wore the short hair and the mustache, no longer silly or affected, but long and derelict and grandiose, accentuating his sadness. His cheeks needed a shave. He wore a shabby blue sweater against the chill of central air conditioning and seemed to be feeling somewhat between sulky and comatose. He was skinny and hollow-eyed and looked like he might even have a soul. As soon as they'd all seated themselves again, the prisoner resumed his mindless downstaring, his head hanging, really motionless, slumped, staring at his own face reflected in a cup of bitter karma. For 3/4 of an hour, the judge read words from a stack of documents, going over all the ins and outs, deliberating aloud to himself from the sound of things. The Chinese youngster just sentenced had run guns for William French Binay. So had many others. The judge went over the list of counts on which Binay had been found guilty here. He referred to the prisoner as a major dealer in illegal arms, a scourge on our lives, a trafficker in our very blood. Storm realized the back pew was the wrong place. Nothing prevented him from getting up and sidling along the rows until he sat right behind the prisoner. Sands turned around at the disturbance, saw Storm, recognized him. turned away. The judge looked small behind his gigantic desk. He called the prisoner an imposter and a psychopath. He ordered the prisoner to rise and sentenced him to be bound with rope, flayed with a cane, and hanged by the neck until he was dead. They had the old high court tricked out like a state capitol, but two blocks away was Little India, where Storm had taken a room. He walked upright through crowds kowtowing at his feet in the streets while public address systems screeched the Islamic afternoon prayers. Wild streetside commerce, a soothsayer lying on the asphalt on his back with a black kerchief covering his face, mumbling predictions. His partner chanted over a collection of rust-colored human bones, including a cranium, arranged on a red scarf around a white hen's egg. They were peddling tiny charms made out of gold foil from 555 cigarette packs and dirty string. The partner lifts the lid on a box. A six-foot cobra rises up, flaring its hood. The partner lifts... sorry. We could be doing that all night if I just keep... if I read that line over and over. Well, look at this thing. I actually borrowed it from Gary. I had intended to read something else. I'll show you. I printed it out with, you know, gigantic type, but I wanted to read something I hadn't read before, so I borrowed this from Gary. My publisher had sent it to him, and I didn't realize they had shrunk this kind of thing down to this little thing. The truth is, I'm making up most of this as we go along. In any case, now we're getting a description of the neighborhood where Jimmy Storm has taken a room. And it's Little India in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And, you know, along the street, there are just all kinds of crazy vendors, including psychics and soothsayers and these guys who sell charms to scare away snakes. And they actually have a cobra that they scare away with their charms, which are made from the tin foil from cigarette packs, just folded up and then tied on a string, as I just read to you at least three or four times. But we'll do it again. The partner lifts the lid on a box. A six-foot cobra rises up, flaring its hood. He backs the cobra down with one of the powerful charms, dangling it in front of the reptile's hissing face. A man nearby displays a pile, a good 5 pounds, of teeth he's yanked successfully. They're all here from the demented corners of the Far East with their straw mats and immortality pills, various elixirs for enlarging the human penis. Also, for the same purpose, a somewhat frightening-looking device of belts and rings, and photo albums showing the cases that have responded. Herbs, unguents, concoctions of every sort, medicinal roots preserved in glass jugs floating like amputations. He entered a small clothing store, its atmosphere almost unbreathable with incense. Impossible to move in here without rubbing against the silk, the rugs. Outside, the mosque still shrieking. The Hindu women standing still and looking at him. Beautiful, three of them. One stared hard and must have been the mother. "I'm here to see Rajik." "Mister is waiting," she said. "Through here?" "Yes, again, like yesterday." "Yesterday?" Her fantastically lovely face and a deep coldness behind it. He hadn't seen her yesterday. He passed through a curtain of painted beads, through its depiction of the god Krishna among bathing virgins at a waterfall, and into the darkness. "Come there. It's fine. Just there." "I can't see." "Wait for your eyes." Storm moved with care toward Mr. Rajik's voice and sat on a cushion on a stool. Mr. Rajik raised his hand to pull a string and ignite a constellation of dim Christmas lights behind him. He was an ordinary-looking Hindu man at a table with a tea service, wearing no expression on his face. "I'll just make a few inquiries. Will you answer?" "Ask me and see." "In the period of the last week, or even a little longer, have you looked at any time to the place where your shadow would be seen, and yet you saw no shadow?" "No." "Have you seen a black bird?" thousands. The world is full of blackbirds. And one that you noticed in particular, because it didn't belong there, I might give you the example of a bird inside a house, or a blackbird perching on your windowsill, a sort of thing such as that. No, nothing like that. Have you seen something, any kind of object, any kind of... Again, I'll use an example. You crumple up a piece of paper, and it resembles someone's head, or a stain of some discoloration on the floor, something that resembles someone's face, the face of someone close to you in the past. Have you seen a thing like that in the last couple of weeks? A thing that suddenly showed you the face of someone close to you? No. I am going to say a prayer for you. What will the prayer be? You tell me. No, I can't be the one to tell you. It's not my place. It's your place to tell me what you would say if you spoke to God. Break on through. Mister was going to do a silence thing now, as if he didn't speak English. I can write it down for you. Mister reached up and turned out the small lights. His hands rustled among his pockets, and he struck a match and lit a stick of incense. The dark curved like a tunnel around them, like solid walls. Very sweaty, nauseated hit now. Gots to go, man, if you want to be fucking with me like this. Mister blew out the match. Nothing now. Your eyes. In 20 seconds, the tiny red ember on the incense became visible, and the little eye that went with the voice, or the nose. This thing was the face, it was all he could see, and it was talking. To break through, you are saying, as through a boundary. Break on through, it's a song. It's my philosophy, my motto. You ask me for the word, that's the word I'm going to have for you. Break on through. Come back tomorrow. That's what you said last time. Mister spoke without urgency, very gently. Have I asked you for any money? Do you feel I'm not to be trusted? So I say to you, come back tomorrow. I can't give you today what I don't have today. Yeah, yeah, do what you have to do, yeah. As storm came within a couple of meters, well, now there's a break, you know, white space. I don't know how you indicate that. You know, like maybe I would become invisible for a second or two. But at this altitude, that wears you out. You know? So now we're in another little section. Well, I can indicate that by taking a little drink of water. As storm came within a couple of meters of Pudu Prison's massive sheet iron gate, he felt the heat of the morning sun banging off it into his face. The guard at the entrance slid a panel aside and peered at Storm out of the dimness of his cubicle, stared at his letter of introduction, which was in English, and made a phone call. Storm waited in the street for several minutes before the guard opened the man-sized metal door in the concrete wall. A tall youth in civilian dress led Storm through the courtyard, where two dozen guards drilled for parade in green and purple uniforms. Ugly bastards. But soon they'd hang Skip Sands, so here's to them. Storm stood outside the warden's office with the letter identifying him as a journalist named Hollis, the name on his Australian passport. A letter calling him a journalist wouldn't do him much good. He understood that. Storm had attached to it a note of his own, explaining to the warden that he also represented a charitable group and wanted to visit the prisoner strictly as a humanitarian, not as a reporter. Manuel Shafi, director and warden of Pudu Prison, greeted Storm cordially. I apologize once again very much, he said, for our policy which prevents me from allowing you inside the prison. But Storm was already inside, here in Shafi's office, with the pictures of the nine sultans overpowering one wall, the air greenly lit by one circular neon tube overhead. Shafi was a little fat man of Indian descent with the pie-shaped and mustachioed face of a cartoon rodent and a jacket frogged with gold braid and five different medallions on each mortarboard epaulette. Also on his chest, ribbons. The impression he conveyed was one of idiotic sweetness. Are you a Muslim? Storm asked. No. Storm said, I myself am a Christian, sir. So am I, the warden said. I am converted. Believe me, I don't like to hang people. Please give Mr. Binet this note, okay? I talked to his lawyer already today, and I think I saw the prisoner give me a nod at the sentencing. It's completely against all regulations. I'm here in a humanitarian role. I'm asking you as one Christian to another. The warden insisted Binet would refuse him in any case. He pronounced the prisoner's name as Benny. Benny wants no visitors, he told Storm. Benny was even rude to the Canada consul. What about his family? Nobody comes. Canada is too far. Make sure he understands I'm the guy who talked to his lawyer. I think he'll see me. But Benny won't see you. I can only keep telling you that. Benny spit in the Canada consul's face. Doesn't that lead you to some conclusion about Benny? I'm pretty sure he'll see me. He has refused all visitors. Otherwise, I could help you. But having fixed on this strategy, having made it Binet's refusal rather than his own, the warden now felt compelled to make Binet prove it. If you please wait, he said, and dispatched a guard to talk to the prisoner. The warden lit a cigarette while Storm listened to the guards drilling out in the courtyard, in unison slamming their rifle butts down on the cracked concrete. Sands and the guard stood together outside the door. Chaffee beckoned them with a tortured look. Sands Binet came in barefoot, wearing shorts and a t-shirt, and it was nice to see him looking so bad, wrecked in his eyes and skinny. Nice to see him looking like a prisoner. Can I talk to him by myself? No. 5 minutes. The warden's face shut, and Storm dropped it. Storm said, How's life? Boring, mostly. You smoke? I finally took it up. You got any cigarettes? These Malaysians smoke 3/5, I think. Yeah, Sands said. I'll give a couple cartons to the lawyer. Thanks. He pretty good? Good enough to get paid while I dangle. You understand the deal here. I'm just a humanitarian, a fellow English speaker. I get it. Benny's consul came to see him, the warden said, and he spit. You're my first visitor. Try spitting at me. Sands stared at his bare feet. Warden Chaffee's a nice guy, Storm said. That's why he's letting me talk to you. He wants to make sure you're comfortable. The thought of getting out of here would comfort me. Not possible, man. You've been found guilty and sentenced, and there's no fooling around here. 83 people have been convicted under the new gun laws, and 82 have hanged. I know the numbers. Storm asked, And how do you feel about hanging? No comments, Chaffee said, though nobody had asked him. Binet shrugged. Hey, at this point, it's okay by me. No comments, Chaffee repeated, but I am a Christian. I think you know my answer. Storm took a step closer to Binet. It's time to think about your soul. Don't be daft. I'm offering you a chance to clear your conscience. I haven't got a conscience, Sands said. So hanging doesn't make you shit? I've lived too long already. What about hell, you fuck? We'll have time to discuss that later, you and I. Lots of time. Benny's got books. He has all kinds of reading matter. He has a Bible, the warden said. Sands stared at his own ugly bare feet and spoke very softly. What did he say? What was that? The warden said. Storm said, Tell me who to see. For what? Old uncle. He's dead, man. He's dead. Yeah? So were you, supposedly. And soon I will be again. You see what I mean about who's who, what's what? You know. But if I were publishing this as a novella, which didn't happen, you wouldn't know any of this anyway. As a novella, it would be like, that would be the sort of the point of the experience. Who's who? What's what? Chaffee's... What happened? Did I lose the mic? All right. Chaffee's unease was palpable now. He indicated the guard. I have a witness. I am nearing retirement in a few months. I could get in a lot of trouble. But he did nothing to stop this. He seemed incapable of the slight rudeness needed at this moment to enforce prison policy. Storm stepped closer. Will you pray? He bowed his head. Dear Lord, he said loudly and then more softly, I know you've got a family in the PI, and I can find them. He stepped back and watched the prisoner shake like a toy until even the stupid warden noticed. He's sick? What's wrong? It's the power of conscience, Storm said. Here, the warden said. Sit down. Yes, the struggle. Now Warden Shafi and Storm stood there like a couple of prisoners, and it was Sands sitting in the warden's chair. Sands gripped the edge of the desk with both hands and looked back and forth from one hand to the other. Zhu Xuan or something like that. He runs a trap up in Garrick. They call him Mr. John or Johnny. Give me directions. You don't need directions. He grabs every euro who comes off the bus. And he's the man to see, if you feel the need. See him for what? The warden said. Not that he didn't get it. He got it. He got the whole thing, but he just wouldn't let himself see he'd made a mistake. Shafi had already failed to prevent this conversation. The best he could hope for now was to dominate it. The two Australians who were executed got no help from their embassy, he remembered now. We've had a lot of foreign prisoners, drugs traffickers, and those such people, he said. I've never seen an embassy take so much interest. The Canadians are very helpful to Benny. Benny's got books, things like that. You're gonna hang, Storm told the prisoner. But life goes on, and everything plays itself out. Inside of every cycle is another cycle. You know what I mean? I hear what you're saying, man, but I don't know what you mean. Storm hitched his chair closer to Sands and leaned forward and said, It's just a machine. Relax. As long as you leave my family out of it. Shafi said, We are civil servants. Please, we have our rice bowls. We want to keep them filled. You're not who you think you are, Storm said. You're dead inside. Sands said, Look, whatever kind of revenge you want, you're not going to get it. Things have to play themselves out. Sands stood up. We didn't pray. He beckoned him close. The warden said, I am a Christian too, an Anglican. I pray for Benny. He's a bit psychotic, depressed, but he's more cheerful the last few weeks. Sands bowed his head, almost touching his brow to Storm's, and hit him with an uppercut below the sternum. Storm's legs gave in, and a lot of tadpoles raced around his field of vision. He said, Yow, Daddy. Shafi helped to hold him upright. Are you sick? What is the problem, sir? Neither the prisoner nor the visitor bothered replying. The pause in communication seemed hard on Shafi. He had to talk. The Red Cross gave us the kind of report I would call useful. Yes, we have areas in the prison to be improved. Hygiene, diet, I appreciated their suggestions, but not the Amnesty International. For instance, we have Chinese gangs. If we don't lock up the members without bail, they'll be out where they can reach the witnesses. The people making the report for Amnesty International didn't understand this. They gave us a very bad report. So you see why we don't want reports. Why should we allow it? We don't want you if you are a humanitarian, he said. We don't want you if you are a journalist. You are not a Christian. I know what a Christian looks like because I myself am already a Christian. This speech had given him strength. Get out, he cried. He turned to the guard. Yes, this man is not permitted here. If we worked on it, I could do this whole reading without any words, you know. We could just establish a little sign language. 30 minutes later, Storm was eating a ribeye steak in a place with a bamboo decor but with an Anglo name, Planters Inn Pub, listening to a wrenchingly beautiful lament played on native flutes, which slowly became recognizable in its sadness as an old moody blues tune, Nights in White Satin. He'd already tried Phangan, the low-rent druggy island resort east of Thailand, but that one flopped. A lot of retrograde-grade hippies with melted eyes, rip-off Indian ganja freaks, various bits of psychedelic European burn-off. Airheads, just air. He couldn't deal with them. This after his escape from the Barnstable County Jail in Massachusetts. One day a door had simply stood open. Surely the agency's doing, and likely the colonel's. And he'd walked away. This after the Great Sea Battle, the only firefight of his life in which the Coast Guard had sunk his boat and many tons of Colombian ganja and shot one and drowned another of his crew of three Colombians. In Bangkok, he'd heard the colonel might be buying and processing raw opium in the region. He moved down from Bangkok, where the whores were friendly and zoned on chemicals, to Kuala Lumpur, where the whores performed with the bloodless efficiency of automatic shoeshine machines. Kuala Lumpur, a name somehow connoting limpness and no warmth, like cold lump. A decaffeinated town, clear acrylic brains, the precise opposite of Fangan. Air conditioning that could reasonably be described as brutal. Everybody seemed to have a respiratory condition. Very Western, very modern, kind of an Asian Akron, Ohio. With cut-rate prices, tropical fruit, and everybody driving on the left. He'd seen the photo of William Binet in the Malaysia Strait Times and had realized that along the way, a sort of psychic and spiritual gravitation had guided his every footstep, and that he had bested the assassin, survived the smugglers, transcended the prison, wandered among the fools, and that he would confront the hanged man or the betrayer, Sands would be revealed for what he was, and that the colonel was now possible. Storm stayed in Kuala Lumpur long enough to get a tattoo and make sure Sands really did hang. He stayed at a spittoon for humanity in Little India called the Bombay, just over a money changer's. They gave him a small blue electric fan and a white towel, but no soap. He could listen to 7 radios at once through the quarter-inch plywood walls. The cheap hotels were short. You were always close to the street in these places, almost down in it. The whistles and exclamations, the baby-voiced horns. The hallways of the Bombay reeked thickly, but not unpleasantly, of curry and Nag Champa incense. In the dawns after the first prayer call, he could smell bread baking on the still air. Then the diesel smoke overpowered everything, rising with the urban noise. Each cycle held another cycle. You could not break out of the machine. He spent the mornings reading from a Bible defiled by some Muslim with a magic marker, or listening to the radio. In his speeches, the prime minister stressed emotional tranquility. Or he wrote in his notebook, efforts in verse. He admired the poet Gregory Corso, a man who spewed out genius by the ream. As for himself, a line now and then. You can't extort the muses. Or he read from his copy of Zohar, the Book of Splendor. He'd picked it up in an English bookshop years ago in Saigon, before the fates had renamed it Ho Chi Minh City. Rabbi Yessa said, Adam comes before every man at the moment he is about to leave his life, in order to declare that the man is not dying because of Adam's sin, but on account of his own sins. Read until his focus loosened and the lines of text divided into duplicates and floated on the page. Half awake, he dreams himself coming to the colonel at the end. And the colonel says, you know, there is a cycle of imagining and desire, desire and death, death and birth, birth and imagining. And we have been tempted into its mouth, and it has swallowed us. He imagined the look in the colonel's eyes as he witnessed Storm breaking a cycle, just for the curiosity of breaking it. He traveled the city, not allowing himself to desire the women, their silk touching past him in tight aisles, on buses, in cafes. On his fourth visit to Rajik, the Hindu gave Storm his answer, speaking again with an immense gentleness. You cannot be healed. You are forbidden to hope for it. You cannot be saved. Maybe we should get another signal. I'll try drinking from two at once. 4 days after the hanging, Storm took a deluxe bus with air conditioning and even TV to the end of the line, the end of the highway itself, in Garrick, a sizable, complicated town of wooden structures and dirt streets. It was nighttime when he disembarked. He walked among the vendors' tables in the square where the buses stopped. Actually, we do know a little bit about who's who and what's what, because earlier the prisoner told him, you can go to this town, Garrick, and look for a guy named Johnny. But you won't have to because he approaches every Euro who gets off the bus. It was nighttime when he disembarked. He walked among the vendors' tables in the square where the buses stopped. Sands had been right. Immediately, Ju Xuan accosted him. A squat, heavy man, he wore shorts, a large T-shirt, walked crab-footed in his Zoris. "Hey, I'm glad you came. Call me Mr. John, okay?" "Mr. John, okay. Want massage? Want woman?" Storm said, "Do you have boy massage?" "Boy massage? Ha! Yes, you want boy?" "Is that too twisted for you, Johnny?" "Boy, girl, fine, anything." "Girl is fine." "Girl massage, fine. You're going to stay at my hotel, okay? 2 blocks. You're American? Germany? Canada? Everybody stays at my place." "Let me get some food." "I got food in my cafe." "I'm going to get some fruit." Storm went among the vendors' tables. He bought a couple star fruit, a mango. Johnny followed him. "You want coconut?" "I'm done." "Then you can have some dinner, and then whatever you want. I get you the lady for the massage." "Dinner later. Woman first," Storm told him. As they went into Johnny's, he pointed out to Storm the establishment next door. "Don't stay in that place," he said. "Don't go there. It's a bad place." It looked pretty much the same as Johnny's. Johnny put him in a room with a straw tatami on its wooden floor and a Muslim toilet with a metal hose. "Wait 1 half hour," Johnny told him. "Don't bring me one that doesn't smile." Johnny brought the girl in 20 minutes. "Smile," he told her in English. "I think I know your friend," he said to the girl when Johnny was gone. "Mr. John is my friend. I think his name is Ju Xuan." "I don't know Ju Xuan. I never heard Ju Xuan." She, too, was Chinese, thick of flesh and friendly. She smelled of the Joss House, of incense. Possibly on the way over, she'd stopped to pray or to contribute. Not, he hoped, to consult the monks as to some ailment. "You seem sad," he said. "Sad? No, not sad." "Then why don't you smile?" She gave him a brief, sad smile. Later, Storm ate out front of Johnny's hotel at a small wooden table under an awning on the street itself, under a paper lantern, in a storm of moths and winged termites. He shared the table with a Malaysian man who tried to talk to him in English. "Don't bother me now, maestro. Whatever you say, I'm all yours." Except for the small lantern over their heads and a few dim-lit doorways, all around them was darkness, damp, warm, stinking like breath. Out of it materialized a skinny European, a young man with an angularity both boyish and plainly British, coming at them like a horror film mummy, his belt cinched around his khakis. Whoops. I improvised that wrong. Doesn't sound right to me. Okay, he's eating out front of the place on the street. Out of it, in the dark, which is the antecedent for the pronoun it. Out of it materialized a skinny European, a young man with an angularity both boyish and plainly British, coming at them like a horror film mummy, his belt cinched and his khakis puckered at the waist, the crown of his head wrapped in dirty bandages. He sat down at the table and said, "Good evening. How can I get served?" I'm not going to do a British accent. I think I'd do a terrific one, but... but I'm, you know, might not work, so... So he's got a, you know, bandage around his head, and he sits down. "Good evening. How can I get served?" Johnny joined them and introduced himself and ordered food for the traveler and conversed in Malay with the other man until, after a while, the other man finished his tea and left. "He doesn't know English. He's a relative from my wife," Johnny explained. He urged on them more bowls of rice mixed with a green lemony weed and bits of shellfish or crisp pork. Storm couldn't tell which. "What happened to your head?" Johnny asked his new guest. "You're okay now, I hope." The young man had been going at his meal seriously, surrounded by whirling bugs. He stopped long enough to say, "Last week I was in Bangkok, just passing through, and I stepped in an open sewer." He went back to his eating. He ate everything. They always did. In the Colombian mountains, Storm had once seen a Brit eat cattle tripe tenderized in kerosene, eat it like a starving man. Pitch black, walking along, right into a concrete ditch. There wasn't a lot of wonderful stuff in there, I might as well tell you. I've been monitoring my symptoms ever since. He spoke mainly to Storm. I fainted right in the guck with an open gash in my head. At this minute, I picture an invading horde of microbes assaulting my skull. I took myself to the nearest surgery in a cab, and the young nurse told me, "You should carry a small light with you wherever you go." A small light, she told me when I came and again when I left with a head full of stitches. Wherever you go wandering, take a small light. Sounds rather like a line from a musical play. Johnny said, "I can meet you to a healer, a woman, massage, to heal you." "I like the Asians," the Brit said. "As a general thing, I find I like them quite a lot. They don't play games the way we do. Of course, I mean, they do the same things we do, but they aren't games. They're simply there. They're simply actions." "This your first visit?" "But not my last. And you?" "I've been in and out since the 60s. "Really? Impressive. In Malaysia, then?" "Yeah, the general region. What about Borneo? Have you been?" "Borneo is not good," Johnny said. "Don't go there. It's ridiculous." "I've got a torch now, you can bet, and it's no small light. Look here." He dug a small but hefty-looking flashlight from the pocket of his pants. "Bore a hole in your flesh." He pointed it playfully at a little child hovering at the edge of the dark. "Bore a hole in your flesh with this one." "Please don't give him any coins," Johnny said. "No, I wouldn't," the Brit assured him. "I've got too many friends in this town as it is." "You have a lot of friends here?" Johnny said. "I'm just playing a game," the young man said. To Storm, he remarked, "You see, Mr. John doesn't play games." Johnny asked, "Are you a sightseer?" "I am when I haven't got 30 stitches in my head." "You are a sightseer. I can get you a guide to the forest tomorrow." "Give me a rest. 2 days and I'm ready for Kilimanjaro." "What about you?" Storm asked Johnny. "Do you hire out as a guide?" "Sure, if you want," Johnny said, "but we'll go slow, and I can't climb the mountain. Just to visit the caves at the Jelai River. I'll show you the caves, and that's all." "That might work out." "There is one small mountain we must pass." "I'll think about it." "The mountain is nothing. It's just more of the same thing. Up, up, up. Are you a sightseer? Maybe we'll see an elephant." "I said I'll think about it." The young man with stitches in his head said, "I met a missionary in Bangkok. He told me to go by Psalm 121. I lift mine eyes unto the hills. I told him I'm a pagan. He insisted I read Psalm 121 every day while I'm traveling. So, was he playing a game? Why tell me something like that?" He filled his bowl once more. Storm watched him eat. "Because it was a message." "A message indeed. But who was the message for?" Storm didn't tell him who the message was for. Johnny said, "I don't like talking about religious things. It makes two people unfriendly." "No, Mr. John," the Brit said. "We're not going to argue, not about religion. It's too boring." "What about a woman for you tonight? What about massage?" The Brit looked disturbed by this talk and said, "We'll mention it later, all right?" Thank you very much.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Oh, that was terrific reading, Dennis.
I want you to notice he has a crib sheet. I do not.
That's right. You're going
all my answers are memorized.
Well, let's start out talking about the new book, which I think you said you've been working on this for off and on since 1982. Is that right?
Yeah, there are parts of it that have been around that long.
Right, and it's as some of you may have picked up, Dennis didn't describe who some of these characters are, but the book is not only about Vietnam, but it's a lot.
That was Malaysia.
Right, that was Malaysia.
There's no reason why you should think it was about Vietnam.
But it's also a lot about the CIA. That's a major part of the book. The main character actually is in the CIA. And I'm just curious to know what led you to this subject, both the subject of Vietnam and to the theme of the CIA. What was it that drew you to that?
Well, when I was a child, my dad was with the United States Information Service, which is basically the propaganda arm of the, and it doesn't exist anymore. I think we've done away with propaganda. Just to, you know, just do whatever the hell we want and explain it to nobody.
Doesn't work anymore.
But believe it or not, there was a time for younger members of the audience when the United States government was concerned with putting a good face on what it was doing, at least trying to look better than the Soviets. And my dad was associated with the branch of the government that did that, the public relations part. He was the, we lived in the Philippines for about 5 years. We lived in Tokyo for about 5 years. This was, for me, between the ages of 7 and 16. And in the Philippines, my dad was the liaison between the CIA and the USIS. I didn't know this at the time. And later he told me it just meant that he would go to meetings with them and they would sort of tell him where areas that USIS was not to be poking their nose into. And also whatever projects they were engaged in, he said they always had enough money. There was never any question about budget or any of that. That's all he ever told me about it. And some of my friends, I learned later, their fathers were in the CIA, but we never had a hint of that because our idea of the CIA was James Bond, like a tuxedo. And I can't remember how many centimeters tall James Bond was, but taller than we were, taller than our dads. And, you know, he smoked 60 cigarettes a day, and then he would go skin diving and shoot, you know, other spies underwater and things. And our dads weren't like that. But it turned out that later I looked in a book called Who's Who in the CIA, which was published by, I know.
Is that really a book?
It was not published by us. It was published by Stasny, I believe is the name of it, the East German intelligence agency in the 1970s. They just put out a little book, you know, outing CIA people. And as I understand it, there were a lot of people in there who were not in the CIA. But so I looked in this book specifically for people who I had known in the 60s, but the fathers of my friends, and several of them were in there. And even to this day, I don't think they would believe it because they were dads. You know, would be found in their undershorts at the breakfast table reading the paper. You know, the CIA, you would never find the CIA doing something like that. In fact, one of them, I told him, his dad was in the book, and he said, well, I don't know if he was in the CIA or not, but I think he clearly was, just the kinds of trips he took and so on. In any case, it was always in the back of my mind, CIA, CIA. And so eventually, as I tried to draw on some of the experiences I'd had in Southeast Asia, and a lot of this book takes place in the 1960s, and the atmosphere of that time in that region, I found myself creating characters in a kind of an imaginary CIA. I didn't do a great deal of research, but I'm not sure a great deal of research will help you very much when it comes to, you know.
Were you more drawn in writing this book by the CIA theme than by the Vietnam theme, or were they equally important for you?
Well, I was writing about the 1960s, although this scene that I read takes place in 1983, it's the last part of the book is kind of how these people ended up much later. But because I was writing about the 60s and Southeast Asia, when our fathers were in and out of Vietnam on a regular basis, Vietnam came into it, and although I've only been there once for a couple of weeks, and that was in recent history. I was never there during the war or anything. It became, well, the book is, I just got the galleys. It's 614 pages long. And I'd say 350 or better of those pages are take place in Vietnam.
Mm. Well, reading it, I felt strongly that you, to a remarkable degree, weren't working out of either conclusions or any assumptions about the politics of the Vietnam War. It's not like this is not a pro-war, anti-war book at all. In some ways, it could almost be any war. You're not writing it as if this is this traumatic, defining political event for much of our generation. It's more you're after looking for different issues, it seems. I'm just wondering, you know, what was your own sense of Vietnam growing when you were in your college days, and what was your attitudes towards it, and then how did that play out in terms of writing this book?
Well, when I was younger, 13, 14, 15, I was waiting to get old enough to enlist and go fight in Vietnam, because we were fighting communists and America was in a war, and I didn't care what war they were in at that age. I wanted to get in it and, you know, blow some things up. And also, I was very much against communism. I didn't know what it was, but the atmosphere I was raised in, I knew it was bad. And that's the way kids are. I mean, when we lived in Washington, D.C., when I was 5 years old, we used to jump out of the bushes at the grown-ups coming home from work and say, "Yankee or a rebel?" And if they said Yankee, we would shoot them. And if they said rebel, we would let them pass. I didn't know what a Yankee was, and I didn't know what a rebel was, but I was living in the Virginia suburbs in the early 1950s, and I knew we were rebels. And that's the way I felt about communism. And then what happened was we came back to the States when I was 16, and actually our next-door neighbor in the Maryland suburbs had a bumper sticker on his car that said, "U.S. out of Vietnam." And I couldn't believe it. I had, you know, and somehow I was drawn in, you know, like towards Satan, you know, to find out more and more and more about why somebody would think that. And pretty soon I realized, you know, they were the rebels over there. And we were the Yankees. We were fighting, in fact, we're called Yankees. Mm. You know, we were the sort of backing up the oppressors, and at least in the simple way I looked at it then. And so I became a demonstrator in college, and I was always against the war and labored very hard to evade the draft, and was successful.
Hmm. And did you ever feel in writing this book any sort of internal pressure to be more political or to deal with those sort of political judgments about the war?
No, I can't say I have any clear understanding about politics.
Mm.
At all, you know. And of course, you know, war and killing and so on, these are moral questions, but even those don't really come up in the book. I guess I feel as if if you want to be moral, you have to practice real disengagement.
Right.
You know, that's your only hope. And, you know, if you get into the situation, then the morals change. The dilemma becomes something immediate, and I've always looked at it that way of people who got drafted. If I'd been drafted and gone over there, then it would have been something else. It wouldn't matter who was the oppressor and who was not.
Right.
If people are shooting at you, then you have to either run away or shoot back or something.
Yeah. No, I've noticed it seems maybe increasingly through your work, there's even the kind of slimiest characters, the most distasteful ones, you rigorously avoid sort of stepping outside and passing judgment on them. You're inside them, and you're letting their own destinies play out. At the same time, there is this incredible, desire in your work to find the right, to find what is right and wrong. Do you feel that there's do you ever feel a tension between those two things, or is it a matter of just immersing yourself in the character and wherever it comes out ends up the way that the morality is written?
Well, I think it's more a matter of immersing oneself in the character and I'm interested and drawn to the characters who are trying to find some kind of spiritual overarching perspective for what they're going through. And sometimes they're very desperate, sometimes they're silly. But I'm very sympathetic to that.
Right. This new book and the previous big novel, not the novella, but Already Dead, are extremely complicated in their plots and have lots of different narrative devices, whereas your earlier work mostly was simpler, although sometimes quite avant-garde in its construction. You feel that you're more drawn towards sort of getting more narrative balls in the air and having a multiplicity of plot lines going? And what's the advantage of that for you in your novels?
Well, in this one, I had a number of characters, and I just wanted to follow each one until everyone's story had been told. Mm. That was basically it. And the rule I made for myself was, let everyone in who wants to come. And I did some cutting later on. But basically, all were welcome. And I'm curious. Now, only probably 3 or 4 people have read both these books, and you're one of them.
Mm.
Do you think this one, this is probably a question he wanted me to ask him. It's probably written down. Does this one hang together better than that other big one?
I think it does, actually.
Okay, good. Of course, what else is he going to say? Yeah. No,
I love the other one, too.
Yeah. Well, the other one is, one reviewer called it a pretentious wreck. I kind of like that. But everybody else just said mess, But I thought this latest one, you can sort of see there are different stories, and they pick up and leave off intermittently, but eventually they all get told, and that's really the plot of the novel.
Do you maybe each book is different, but when you wrote this one, was the genesis of it more character driven, or did you see a storyline arcing out in advance, or was it a mixture of the two?
Well, it started out just examining these characters and so on, but since some of them become involved in a plot, they are making a plot. And the plot involves creating a fiction for disinformation. The book sort of has, I can hardly bring myself to say it, a plot.
Right. When you were reading the dialogue between Benet, which is not actually his real name, and Storm in that scene, it really reminded me of some of your plays. The dialogue is very loaded, and it's almost like Pinter. There's like a lot of lines that go by each other. There's a lot of malevolence kind of below the surface. And I think, some of your dialogue in your earlier novels is like that too, but I wonder if you feel that writing for the theater has affected your writing, and especially your dialogue in that way.
Yeah, it really has affected the way I look at scene. In fact, I never would have used the word scene before getting involved in the theater, but they're always, scene. I begin to see that what works on the stage is kind of where everybody on the stage wants something. Mm. And I actually became conscious of that as something that I wanted in the scenes I create in fiction as well. So I'm actually thinking more about what the scene is doing and so on, rather than just jumping in and having people chatter away. I'm strongly implying that this is an improvement over previous books.
But I think you always had, that passage I read from Resuscitation of a Hanged Man when English meets Leanna, and I think that you said that actually scene was the one that actually got you, when you saw that performed, that got you into the theater. But you, I think, always had that sense of having really low conversations from outer space, you could almost say, where they go so much deeper than conversations that you would expect them to. Would you like to talk about what actually got you interested in theater?
I went to the Met Theater in L.A. where some actors were reading some of my stories. It was like a two-evening experience. And the first evening, actors read some of my stories, and then the next evening, there was only one story left over for me. I'd only written half a dozen at that point. But a couple of them acted out a scene from a novel, and I was really swept away by the experience of sitting in the audience and seeing these characters actually alive and hearing them talk and being with the audience and hearing the audience react, which you can't do as a novelist. You know, I mean, you can sneak up beside somebody, you know, and see, you know, but that's never happened. I've never sat on an airplane and look, you know, I always look at the books, you know, where they, you know, it's always like Stephen King, you know, and like, so, I mean, I haven't even seen a person experience one of something I've written.
You know. Right.
But with a play, I mean, there you are. And the experience just really took me instantly. And I immediately started writing plays and looking around for people to perform them. And it is wonderful. I mean, you're left to the mercy of actors. But then when somebody's reading something by themselves, you're at the mercy of whatever distractions they may have or whatever level of interest they have. And it just, there's a feeling that you can make it more vivid if the if the actors are doing their job.
Do you find that you have to rewrite more for the theater? Because on times when I do things that have to be performed or spoken on stage, they don't always come across the same way as they do when they're written on the page. I wonder if you end up with dialogue, like tweaking it
more. Yeah, there's a lot of just... Generally, the play is all there, but then scene by scene, we take things out or put things in, you know, do a lot of adjusting to make something that works in real time.
Right. Let's go back to your most celebrated book, Jesus' Son. Could you talk a little bit about how that book came to be? I know you had written some sketches and that you had in your drawer, but I know you had not originally wanted to publish them because you thought they were too revealing.
Yeah.
But what led you to change your mind?
Well, these were just anecdotes from my misspent youth. Mm-hmm. And to begin with, there were things that I would tell people just to amuse them, you know, once in a while. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people would say, you should write these things down, make it a story. And one day I did write several of them down and just threw them in a drawer, but I kept tinkering with them. I liked the voice, and I was particularly attracted to the voice because it had a double quality. And sometimes it seemed like the narrator was actually in the moment and very young, but other times that the narrator had lived through all this and was looking back, and the perspective could kind of go back and forth. Mm. And eventually I had half a dozen, seven stories, I think, but I wasn't going to publish them because I thought they were too revealing, even though by that time I was making stuff up left and right and stealing other people's anecdotes. But I just, and you know, it just didn't seem as if I wanted to parade that aspect of my life around. And then I got sick. I got malaria when I was on a journalism assignment, and I was broke, and I was really sick. I was in the coronary care unit for 9 days, And it looked like I was going to croak. And then when I came out of it, I thought, who cares? You know? I mean, we all just end up dead anyway. So, you know, let them read what they want about me. You know, it was a very liberating experience. And I was broke, so I gave them to my agent. And he sold a couple of them. And then I wrote some more.
And then they were mostly published in The New Yorker.
Yeah.
And then Farrar Straus published the book.
Right.
Were you shocked at the amazing success? It was a new experience for you.
Well, it got a lot of good reviews.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call it amazing success, but it's had a longevity that does kind of amaze me. And there are still young writers who come up to me all the time and say, I read this book and that decided me. I want to become a writer. Mm. I don't know what that means. Does it mean it looks easy, you know, or because it is just a short little book, you know, and just sort of dash off experiences from your past. And
maybe I did a lot of drugs. I can be a writer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know?
Today, if a lot of writers, there's a craze for memoirs, and if a writer today was to write Jesus' son, the chances are they might write it as a memoir. I'm interested to know what you think about whether or not you can be as truthful, paradoxically, writing a book like this in straight memoir form as you can in a fictional form.
No, I don't think so. That's actually what got me out of journalism. It's just the idea that, you know, having to stick with the facts is, I mean, because the facts can be an awful lie if you just present them. And I think it's better to mess around with things and make stuff up, and then you can sort of stick better with the truth, I think.
So it's almost as if you aim directly at the truth, you don't hit it. You have to aim at something else, and then you
get it. Yeah, it's like the sun.
Right.
You can't stare directly at it.
Yeah.
Or like these lights.
Right. Which writers have most influenced you in your career?
Chekhov, Isaac Babel or Isaac Babel, Mark Twain.
Which books of Twain do you like the most?
Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn.
Mm.
And actually, he was the one that got me started. If he were alive, I'd go and say, I read Tom Sawyer, and I decided I'm going to be a writer, too.
Right.
You know, I started writing books when I was a little kid. You know, I started a number of novels all about, you know, a kid just like me. And they didn't turn out like Tom Sawyer. You know, 6 or 7 pages in, I would throw them aside and start something else. But that's what I wanted. I wanted to write a Tom Sawyer kind of book, only I would be the star. And, you know, my parents would forgive me and so on.
Right.
Or they'd be amused by the things that they had been punishing me for previously.
One of the things that's always amazed me about Twain, especially in Tom Sawyer, is it seems that he can just completely channel being 12 years old, as if there'd been no intervening time whatsoever. Do you have some of that facility yourself? Do you feel like you can still go back into your childhood and touch into that? Or
I think there's actually some kind of self-hypnosis involved.
Mm.
And when I'm writing, I'm able to summon up details and things that I wouldn't, you know, if you had me in a courtroom and asked me what was going on in the room, I'd say, I don't know. I think there were some people there. But then when I'm actually writing something, things come much more vividly.
Yeah. Which of your own works are your favorites now? Do you have some of your own books that you feel that are either the most successful or that you just love the most?
Well, the only ones I think are any good are a book of poetry called The Incognito Lounge, this novel, Angels, and Jesus' Son. I like that a lot. And then a couple of the plays I like, too. This last book, I can lie.
That's a pretty harsh judgment on all your other works. What? Why is it you don't think they work?
I don't know. I just repudiate them.
But there are things about them that you must like.
Yeah, I like the way they're written. That's why I'm a writer's writer.
Right.
You know, the writing's good, but the books are not.
Well. I think this shows that even great writers can have appallingly bad judgment. And
these books, some of them I just started, and I thought I saw something on the horizon, and I aimed for it, and it was just a whale, and he was gone, and, you know.
Well.
And then the book was over, and you're in the middle of the sea, you know.
Well, I think for most of your readers, they enjoy being in the middle of that sea. And on that note, I think we'll say good night and thank you very much. Thanks to Dennis Johnson.
Thanks so much, Dennis, for coming.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.